You are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Today's Monday, November 30th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear the second half of an interview with Scott Russell Sanders, author of the new book, A Conservationist Manifesto, published by Indiana University Press. The first half of the interview, in case you missed it, is now available for free download at our podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. Distinguished professor of English at Indiana University, Bloomington, Scott Russell Sanders is the author of 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, including Writing from the Center, Hunting for Hope, and A Private History of Awe. He is winner of the Lannan Literary Award, John Burroughs Essay Award for Natural History, AWP Award in Creative Nonfiction, and the 2009 Mark Twain Award. I interviewed Scott Russell Sanders earlier this month when he was in Burlington to speak at the Fletcher Free Library. In the late 90s, you wrote a book called Writing from the Center. This is a quote from that book. The writer who is steadfast rather than footloose risks being dismissed as regional or quaint. What could be more backward than staying put in a culture that rushes about? How can you see the big picture from a small place? This is a theme that readers will find again in the Conservationist Manifesto, these ideas about rushing and never slowing down or being still. I wonder if you can, this is a theme that runs through your work, and also the theme of writing from home, writing from the center, which you touch on in this book, and I think probably the caring for home ground is certainly a reflection of that. So can we just talk about that a tiny bit more?
We live in a society that is fixated on celebrity, not just celebrity of people, but celebrity of places, so that there's a relatively small number of cities in America, obvious places like New York and Los Angeles and Seattle and so forth, that are thought of as real places, alive places, places that are good to live in, places where interesting things happen and interesting people live. And those certainly are all wonderful places. But most Americans live elsewhere. Most Americans live in small towns in Vermont or farm villages in Indiana or in medium to small cities like Burlington or Indianapolis or St. Louis and so forth. And those are real places too. Real human life occurs there. And it seems that it shouldn't be necessary to say that. But many people who grow up there and become writers or become photographers who grow up in places that are not the celebrity cities tend to dismiss the places they come from as not worthy of their attention. Nobody's ever going to publish a book that is set in rural Vermont. Nobody's ever going to publish a book that's set in a small town in Bloomington, in Indiana. You have these preconceptions. And to a considerable extent, the media reinforce those preconceptions. Well, my view is that human life happens everywhere humans live. And the things that matter to humans, life and death and falling in and out of love and birth of children and the pursuit of causes and the development of skills and pursuit of work and so forth, those things happen wherever there are humans. Mm-hmm. And all places deserve attention. They deserve not necessarily uncritical praise. I think loving a place and caring about a place includes the willingness to recognize its shortcomings and to, insofar as it's within one's power, to work to remedy those shortcomings, to not just condemn them, but to actually try to overcome them. So I live in a place, more generally I live in this region of the Midwest, which by and large is a place that writers, great American writers, have tended to leave. So there's a whole long list of great American writers, Mark Twain and Toni Morrison and T.S. Eliot and Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Willa Cather, a very long list of marvelous American writers who were born and grew up in the Midwest and all left to go elsewhere. There are now, thanks to universities primarily, there are now many marvelous writers living and working throughout the Midwest. But many of them...
Even people from New York City, probably.
Even people from New York City. But Unfortunately, many of the writers who now live and work throughout the Midwest, thanks to the positions that people enjoy, as I enjoy one, at universities, but many of them don't set their work in the Midwest. They set them elsewhere, places that they think of as more interesting, more desirable. I've been very intent on setting my work where I live, beginning with my hometown, beginning then moving out to southern Indiana, then Indiana as a whole, and then the Great Lakes region and the Midwest. Not because I think it's the most beautiful place or the most interesting place or the most important place, but it's my place. It's the place that I know. And it's a place that deserves attention, deserves art being made about it, as does every other place on earth. We live in a society that so values mobility. Mm-hmm. And mobility certainly has great benefits and advantages and attractions. I understand them. I travel a lot. But I have a home base from which I travel. And I bring back to my home base, where I've now lived with my wife for 38 years, I bring back to that home base the benefits of what I learn elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And the home base, to some extent, if only modestly, is then enriched by my travels. So I don't travel just for my own sake. I travel for what I'm able to bring back and invest in my teaching, in my writing, and in my dealings with neighbors.
Yeah. You wrote an essay for the AWP Chronicle some time ago, and you mentioned something along these lines. How can one think responsibly about life in our time or discover the full potential of literature without a lively interest in other cultures?
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like you really feel that you write best about the place you're from, and particularly if you have other knowledge to bump that up against. Is that?
Yes. What's called provincialism is an attitude that where you're from and what's known in the place where you're from, what foods are eaten, what religion is practiced, etc., is all you need to know about the world. And if you do have that attitude, whether you're from New York City or from Bloomington, Indiana, you are a provincial. That is, you are narrow-minded. Sure, there may be wonderful things where you are, but it does not begin to exhaust the possibilities, the rich possibilities of human culture. So it seems to me any place is enriched by knowledge that comes from elsewhere. And again, that includes big cities, as well as small towns, as well as homes in the country. In my own experience, there certainly are people who live in rural places or live in small towns, live throughout the Midwest, say, there certainly are people who are provincial in that sense, narrow-minded, they're not curious about other people, other places. But I've met just as many people who are narrow-minded in that way from Chicago and from Los Angeles and from New York City. So being provincial is not a function of where you live, it's a function of your attitude about the adequacy of what you actually know about your home place. Is that enough to know? We live in this age when you can learn a great deal about almost any culture on the planet. You can learn it through the internet, you can learn it through television, through films, through books, and so forth. You can learn it if you have the time and have the money and have the inclination, you can learn a lot of it from travel. I have done a fair amount of traveling in other countries, but mainly earlier in my life. When I was in graduate school for 4 years in England, my wife and I traveled a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in Europe. But there are many huge swaths of the world that I have never visited and probably never will visit. And the main reason for that is ecological. It's very, very costly to move people around the planet. But another reason is that I live on this continent that itself is endlessly diverse in its culture, in its biology, in its geography. And I will never in my lifetime exhaust 1% of what there is to know about this continent I live on. The mm-hmm. cultural varieties, the architecture, the creatures, the landscapes. So, and I'm so fascinated by and so moved by the American landscape and the variety of geographies and cultures that have mixed here in this country. I'm so moved by it that when I get the chance to travel, this is where I want to travel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very interested in other countries. I read a lot about them. I seek out every opportunity to talk with people from other countries, to read books by people from other countries. to watch films about them and so forth. So I try to learn more about, as much as I can, about the rest of the world. But I actually have focused my own travels on this country.
Mm-hmm. I find myself wondering if you feel the same way about time. Do you personally feel more of a pull to write about your own time?
Well, I certainly, in my early writing, very interesting question, in my early writing, I wrote mainly about the past.
Uh-huh.
I wrote about family history, not in a biographical way, but I wrote fiction that was inspired by stories my mother had told me about her ancestry, stories my father had told me about his boyhood and his ancestry. So they were fiction, but they were fiction inspired by things from the past. One of my earliest novels is a historical novel set in Ohio in 1813, about a murder that occurred there, a historical novel. And then I went through a period of time when I actually wrote novels that were set in the future, that are therefore presented as, published as science fiction novels. And they're in the near future. I wrote them in the 20th century, but they were set in our present century, in the 21st century, mid to late 21st century. And they were efforts, of course, to comment on my own time, but to do so by projecting possible developments into the future. So it's a kind of speculative fiction that exaggerates or pursues current trends, technological and cultural trends, to imagine where they might lead if we continue to pursue them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this fiction which was really set in the future, but of course it was about my own time. In the same way in which my fiction about the past was set in the past, but was really about my own time. So that the novel that I referred to, it's called Bad Man Ballad, which is about this murder, an actual murder that occurred in early Ohio, early in the 19th century. At the root of that was my own brooding about the Vietnam War and about the obsession with violence, with guns, with essentially warfare that characterizes our culture. We live in a very militaristic society.
Right.
And I wrote a novel set in the past as a way to think back to some of the roots of that, which have to do, I'm sure, I'm convinced, as are a lot of much better informed historians, it has a lot to do with our continent-wide encounter with the wilderness, including our encounter with all the creatures who live there, including all the native peoples who live there. So we live in this place now called Vermont because our European ancestors killed or forced out all the native people who occupied this place, who lived here, for whom this was home. And that was true right across the whole country. So I have, I've gradually worked my way back to the present, if you will. In my present work in A Conservationist Manifesto, the final section of the book, as I mentioned earlier, is projected into the future. It's really talking, it's inviting the reader to think about where our society is headed, mm-hmm. what our legacy is for future generations. But the book starts very much with the present. And
what we can do now.
And what we can do now, right, absolutely.
Right. You've said that you live and have led a rather ordinary life.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever feel intimidating to you writing memoir, knowing people will be reading about what you consider to be an ordinary life?
In some ways, my answer to that is similar to my answers about place. Most people do not live in extraordinary places. They don't live in sensationally beautiful or wildly historic or globally significant places.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't. Similarly, most people don't lead lives that are full of sensational events. And yet all lives deserve attention. And I'm a writer, as I've said it explicitly in my writing, such as, for example, in the preface to my next most recent book, A Private History of Awe, I say in the preface to that book that this is an account of the most luminous moments in a very ordinary life. And my point of writing about my life is not because I think my life is inherently important or inherently worthy of the reader's attention, but as an invitation for the writer to think about his or her own life. Because after all, most people don't lead sensational lives. They're getting the kids up out of bed and getting them to school, they're paying bills, they're going to work, they're buying groceries, they're doing the laundry. And there may be high points and low points in their life, but most of our lives are filled with unsensational events. They fill our days, and sometimes they fill our entire lives. Nonetheless, those are real lives. Those are lives that have depth to them, have significance to them, have beauty, moments of insight in them. And they deserve our attention. They deserve serious reflection. I think too many Americans live vicariously through celebrity culture. They look at the wealthy or the famous on television, or they see them in magazines, and they think, oh, those people have real lives. Those people have interesting lives, rich lives, whereas my own life is so plain and so uninteresting. That seems to me almost tragic abandonment of reflection and appreciation of one's own life, no matter how plain one's own life may seem, no matter how hard it may be. It's worthy of our attention, and if we pay attention to it, it will enrich our experience. Mm-hmm. And we will have more to give to the people around us as well.
I would say that a conservationist manifesto has a sort of hopeful, it's not too late undertone running through it. And I know you wrote a book called Hunting for Hope, which collected writings concerning that subject, remaining hopeful despite the world's sometimes bleak-looking position. Can you talk about how you remain hopeful? I know that's a big subject, but...
Yeah. Hope is a big subject, but it's also a vital one. To some extent, hope is temperamental. Some people are despairing by temperament, and some people are hopeful. I make a distinction between hope and optimism. Mm-hmm. And I make it in that book that you referred to called Hunting for Hope. Optimism is the confidence that things are going to turn out fine. Hope is the conviction that however things are going to turn out, however they may turn out, there's always good work to be done. There are real sources of healing and renewal that we can draw on to do good work. And I'm hopeful in that sense, but I'm not optimistic. That is, if you say, am I confident that things are going to turn out right, that humans are going to really come to grips with these enormous challenges that we face, am I confident that's going to happen? No, I'm not confident. In fact, I think the odds are pretty long. On the other hand, do I think that there are grounds for doing good work, healing work, renewing work, both as an individual, as part of communities, and parts of our species? Do I think that there are grounds for real hope that we can address these problems and create a more humane, a more conserving society? Yes, there definitely are. And I'm glad that you feel a sense of hopeful mood in a conservationist manifesto, because it's definitely there. I wouldn't write a book about taking care of the earth, taking care of human constructions, if I didn't believe that there would be many people who would respond to that, who would resonate to that appeal, people who are in fact making that effort in their lives right now, and people who are inclined to do it, who might find the book the impetus to invest themselves more in living simply and in taking care of things. I wouldn't be a teacher if I weren't hopeful. One of the reasons I think that I do feel a profound sense of hope for the human future is that I have seen so much learning occur. One of the great privileges and gifts of the life of a teacher is whatever frustrations, whatever shortcomings one has, may have as a teacher, you see learning occur. You see this repeated evidence of the human capacity to learn. I experience it in myself, of course. I've learned my whole life, and I expect to learn as long as I'm alive. And I see it in students. I see it in people who write to me having read one of my books, that they've learned something from that, they've been given something from that. So hope is an enormous subject, and these few remarks are not adequate to it, but I do feel that it's one of the responsibilities of elders to think hard about our present challenges, and also to speak honestly and forthrightly about what we see as the way forward. That is, elders are people who are not defined just by chronological age, although they tend to be older chronologically. But they're people who've turned their thoughts towards the needs of those who come after them. In other words, they're no longer preoccupied with their own careers, their own needs even, but actually with the needs of those who are alive now and who are going to be alive after they're gone. And I see myself as an elder in that sense. I don't mean that I have laying claim to any particular wisdom or authority, certainly, but I do feel a sense of obligation.
Okay. What are you working on now?
Well, although I'm best known as a writer of essays and nonfiction, as it happens, right now I'm working on a novel. Started as what I thought was a collection of linked stories, but has evolved into a novel. The characters wouldn't stay compartmentalized in their stories. They keep spreading out to adjoining chapters. So it's become a novel. And it's a novel, really, that although it has pays a lot of attention to settings, because I've always loved geography and landscape, it's really about relationships, which most novels are about. And it's partly a way for me, having brooded for a long time on the grand ills and challenges of the world, environmental degradation and war and peace and so on, it's sort of a relief for me to think about a much more small-scale, intimate set of relationships and just explore those for a while. I will go back to the big global concerns.
Well, and I'm sure they'll be there as well.
Yes, they're not going to go away. So right now I'm working on a novel, and I have an idea for a book of either essays or a book of chapters, nonfiction, that would be about efforts to create what I call arcs in the Conservationist Manifesto, efforts to create alternative economies, alternative social structures, alternatives to the dominant patterns that and very destructive patterns that we have now in America. So, for example, local foods as opposed to international industrially grown agriculture, local economies as opposed to global corporations, craft work, hand work as opposed to mass production, manufacturing. So a book that would be a series of profiles or studies in these efforts all across our country to create an alternative economy, an alternative society.
Oh, wow. That sounds wonderful. What advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Writing can be blocked by a lot of factors. Just the busyness of our lives. We don't have enough clear space to think through the project. We lose the energy that was required to carry it on. We lose the spark, the dream, the inspiration. But let's say you have the time, you have the space, you are really eager to write, but you're still struggling to find your way forward in a piece. And there are a lot of different influences that can block someone. One of them is having too high an expectation of the draft that you're working on. Unless it's perfect, or unless it's earth-shattering or unprecedentedly great, it's not worth writing. Well, I understand that because I hear those voices in my own head as I write. But I think you have to allow yourself to pursue a work even though you know it needs to be improved, needs significant improvement, so that you have something down that you can then rework, because you can't improve something until you have something to work on, work over, to revise. So one thing to do is to defend yourself against that voice in your head that says this isn't good enough, is to speak back to it and say, well, I know it's not good enough, but it's also not finished. It's a draft. It's on the way towards something that will be good enough. So just talk back to that little voice. There's another voice that discourages us and blocks us in our writing, and that's the voice that says, who's going to ever care about this? There's so much to read in the world. This will never get published, or even if it is published, nobody's going to read it. It won't matter to them. Well, that may be true. There is a lot written, and a lot more written than is ever going to get published. But my response to that little voice is to say, even if nobody ever else reads this, even if it's never published, the practice of writing it is going to enrich my life. It's going to deepen my understanding of this life that I'm leading, this mysterious human existence. It's going to deepen my understanding. It's going to give me the satisfaction of having shaped something out of words, the way another person might make a chair out of wood or might make bread out of dough or a pot out of clay. There's something inherently satisfying in making something out of words. So I just say to that little voice that says, this is not important, this is will never be of interest to others, I say, so what? It matters to me. I'm going to learn from this. I am learning from this, and I'm going to get, however hard and frustrating and arduous the actual making may be, I'm going to get the satisfaction of having made something out of words. And then maybe, just maybe, if I make it well enough, maybe actually some other people will take an interest in it. Maybe I'll send it to my friends on my email list. Maybe I'll show it to people in my writer's group. Or maybe it'll get published somewhere and more people will read it. Maybe that will happen. But I don't need to know that that will happen or even be confident that that will happen in order to feel that the writing itself is worthwhile. One of the things I do when I feel blocked that way is I open a book that I love, and I have lots of them. Every writer has lots of books that you love, writers that you love, and so forth. I open such a book, and I just open it anywhere, and I just read a few paragraphs, which is a way of reminding me, yes, this is why people write. Mm-hmm. They write in the hopes that they might make something this good or almost this good, or maybe for a few pages they'll write this well. It's as though you're a musician and you don't want to practice. Because who wants to practice, right? But you love music, and you put on a piece of music that's absolutely spellbinding. And that reminds you, okay, that's why I practice. I practice because I love this music, because I don't have to imagine that I'm ever going to be this good, but I can imagine that that's the direction I want to aspire to. That's where I want to move. So that's the kind of thing I will do when I get blocked. Or I'll maybe go back and read something occasionally that I've written earlier, maybe something that got published, and remember how raw it seemed when I started it, how unsure I was when I started it, how long I had to grope around before I found the final shape that's now in print, just to remind myself what it felt like and how uncertain I was early in the phase of that. And yet here was this finished thing that I now feel good about and that other people seem to find some value in. And just reminding myself of that is reassuring.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Scott Russell Sanders. Next week, tune in to hear a talk with the poet Charles Harper Webb. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Scott Russell Sanders, who is a writing teacher as well as a writer. Think about the classic elements as the Greeks imagined them: air, earth, fire, and water. Say the words over and over in your mind. Settle on one of them: air, say, or earth, or fire, or water. And then begin to think about what associations you have in your own life with that element. Water can be ice, moving water, a pond, something you drink, snow, mist, clouds. You could think about a place where you encountered water in some foundational way, where you learned to swim, or a snowstorm you got caught in your car once, or sledding down a hill as a child. Write a list, not a narrative, but a list of all these associations and memories, sledding, ice fishing, snowball fights, whatever, and then pick one or two of these items from your list and begin to write. Begin to unpack it and see where it goes. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I should mention that the views expressed on this show are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management, board, or any of its affiliates. Next week, so that's December 7th, at 1 o'clock in the hour before this show, you'll be able to hear former Write the Book guest Laurel Neamy hosting The Wildlife, a new Radiator program, in which Laurel interviews scientists, law enforcement officials, and others about the latest in wildlife research and investigation. Laurel's first interview will be with Christine Heinrichs, who will talk about elephant seals. Christine Heinrichs is the docent at Piedras Blancas State Park in California, where over 15,000 elephant seals rest, give birth, and raise their young after 8 to 10 months foraging in the deep ocean. That show is The Wildlife with host Laurel Neamy, starting next week, Monday at 1 o'clock. And now I'm going to announce the death of a wonderful poet and a dear friend to the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA and Writing Program, Jack Myers, who was a longtime faculty member of that program. He was also a professor of English and creative writing at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and he was the author of 18 books of and about poetry. Jack's many honors included two fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, multiple university residencies, first place in the National Poetry Series, and selection as the 2003-2004 Poet Laureate of Texas. Jack Myers served as the co-vice president for Association of Writers and Writing Programs, the AWP, from 1993 to 1995, as well as having been chairman of the Writers Garret, a Dallas literary center founded by his wife, Thea Temple. Jack's writing seeks to discover the extraordinary within the ordinary by fusing Eastern influences to Jungian psychology while being grounded in an ironic humor and working-class sensibility. Jack Myers passed away peacefully Monday evening in his home. I'd like to read a poem written by Jack Myers titled Cirrus. I'd like to leave a lighter imprint on the world than I'd formerly meant, just a scent. Not the thud of the thing steaming on a plate. Instead of I told you so, let my epitaph be the glance, the edge, the mist, the delicately attenuated swirl of an innuendo instead of a thunderhead. The rain that fell when I was ambitious seemed conspiringly rushed in my way, but the same rain today tastes of here and now because of where it's been. I'd like to be gentle with small great things. They are larger than what we think we came here for. I'd like to be an eye of light that opens the air and burns beyond ambition, like the sun that can't see us and is beyond our reach, yet is in us a trillion times over. That's the poem Cirrus by Jack Myers, who passed away Monday night. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you the world of music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.
Thank you.